Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. 150 years ago this week, the Civil War was drawing to a close, and Vermont troops played an important role at the Battle of Petersburg, a battle that led to the fall of Richmond and the surrender by Robert E. Lee. Well, how did Vermont troops influence the final weeks of the Civil War? With us today to help answer that question and many more is Vermont Civil War historian Howard Coffin. Howard, great to have you here.
Always good to be here, Bob.
You can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Maybe you have some questions about Vermont's involvement in the Civil War. We've got the person who can answer those questions. Maybe you had some relatives who fought in the war. We'd love to learn about that. There might be some Civil War monuments in your community. And if you are interested in the Civil War, what is it about this conflict that draws you in? 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net or give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. So before we discuss the specific events of April 2nd, that being the Battle of Petersburg, April 3rd, the fall of Richmond, April 9th, which would be when Lee surrenders, that's all coming up. Give us a sense of what was going on towards the end of March of 1865. I think some people might be feeling, gee, the war was almost over. The Southern troops were running out of resources. It was just a matter of days before this war was going to be over. But does that match the reality of the situation?
Not really. The soldier letters, Vermont soldier letters, show that they had high hopes that the war was almost over. The focus was at Petersburg, 30 miles south of the Confederate capital at Richmond, which was the rail center for Richmond. And if you couldn't hold on to Petersburg, Richmond could not be held. And so the great effort had been going on for 9 months was to break the lines there at Petersburg and then capture Richmond. But even Ulysses Grant, who led the effort for 9 months of trying, could not do it. And people were getting pretty discouraged across the North.
And there's a famous meeting towards the end of the war between President Lincoln and Ulysses S. Grant and probably some other military folks, where they express a lot of concern that maybe this war isn't going to just end on a certain day. Perhaps the Southern troops are going to run to the Blue Ridge Mountains, and this is going to be guerrilla warfare, and it could go on for years and years to come. And they express great concern that that could be the outcome.
Well, that was a real possibility. And at Appomattox, after the surrender, several of Lee's commanders suggested that he release his forces to take to the mountains and keep the war going. And to Lee's everlasting credit, he said, absolutely not. It will destroy the country. Now, Lee had been talking in terms for the previous 4 years of the countries, the Confederacy and the United States of America, but in this conversation he uses country, so he's conceding that the war is lost and we're back together again. And it was mainly due to Lee that this did not happen, and it would have been awful.
And also at that meeting, I've read that President Lincoln also made it very clear that once the war was over, there would be no hangings of Southern generals. There would be no bloody retribution. We got this email asking about this from Henry, who wrote us, Robert E. Lee became a college president after the war, Pickett an insurance agent. Often leaders of the losing side in a war are punished, say, by execution. Why did Andrew Johnson proclaim amnesty?
Well, that really goes back to Abraham Lincoln. Just before he died, he makes it clear that he doesn't want the South heavily punished, but he does want a reconstruction that allows black people to rise, and he wants the South controlled so this can happen. But it's Lee and Grant in the surrender agreement at Appomattox who come to the terms that allow the Southern soldiers to go home, even the generals to take their sidearms, and then as a last appeal, even to take their horses so they could get on with the spring plowing.
Today on the program, our guest is Vermont Civil War historian Howard Coffin. If you've got a comment or a question, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Let's go up to Montreal and talk to Brian. Hi, Brian. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks for the invite. I'm calling from this side of the border because we get a different view of the Civil War. It wasn't our fight, although we were sort of peripheral because we were mildly aligned with the South. We liked them as a market for our manufactured goods, and they supplied us lots of cotton. But by the end of the war, they were a beaten power. And so we're told in our high school history books that one of the reasons Canada is 148 years old is because you won your war 150 years ago, and a winning army, the Northern Army, has a hard time stopping when it's on a run. How many Vermonters were enrolled in the army by the close of hostilities? And does your guest know whether there was a movement among Northerners to keep on going and, you know, fulfill manifest destiny?
34,238 Vermonters served in the Civil War. Official records say that 5,224 of them died, although I think that the number is closer to 6,000. There was a little talk about surging northward. You know, Vermonters weren't awfully happy with the Quebecois because, the Confederate raiders who robbed the St. Albans banks had come down from your territory. But there was no serious thought given to an invasion of Canada, except by the Irish Fenians, who took a stab at it not long after the Civil War and got only a few hundred yards across the border.
Let's go to April 2nd and the Battle of Petersburg. Tell us about that battle and Vermont's involvement with that battle.
Well, as I said, Ulysses Grant had been trying for 9 months to break the lines, and he could not do it. And then at the end of March, he really got serious, and he brought Phil Sheridan in from the Shenandoah Valley with 10,000 cavalry, including the 1st Vermont Cavalry Regiment. And on the first day of April, they struck the western end of the Confederate lines. And those Confederate lines protecting Richmond and Petersburg were 50 miles long. And Sheridan smashes in the western end of the line and doesn't break the lines, but forces Lee to move a lot of troops that way. So the thought is that something's weak along the main part of the line. Well, the commander of the 1st Vermont Brigade, Lewis Addison Grant, they all called him the other Grant, on the 25th of March had gone out scouting along the lines, and he had seen what he thought was a weakness in the Confederate lines near the city of Petersburg. There was a 60-foot gap in the earthworks where sentries went in and out and a stream flowed through it. And he thought that a heavy attack would break through there. He took it up to Horatio Wright, who commanded the 6th Corps, and Wright took it to George Gordon Meade, and Meade took it to Grant, and Grant came out and had a look, and he said, I think it might work. And so the attack was ordered for first light on the second day of April, 1865, 150 years ago, yesterday. And the whole 6th Corps was involved, 14,000 men, bigger than Pickett's charge. And in the darkness, they were formed in a wedge-shaped formation with the point facing the Confederate works. And at the tip of that point was the Vermont Brigade. And at the tip of the Vermont Brigade was the 5th Vermont and a company led by a captain named Gould from Windham, Vermont. Well, it's a dark, damp night. At midnight, a Vermont artillery cannon fires a signal gun, and 150 Union cannon open on the Confederate lines for 2 hours. It stops at 2 a.m., and then the 14,000 men are moved out in the darkness out toward the Confederate works, and they have to lie there until 4 a.m. or 4:30 a.m. until they get the order to attack. And right at the point is Charles Gould of Windham. Interesting kid to have been out there, 24 years old. As a child in Windham, at 3 years old, he'd fallen into a vat of boiling maple syrup on his grandmother's wood stove. They said he'd never walk again. He was scalded. But he grew up to be a hellion kid and ran off to enlist, and now he's a captain. And he's out there at the point of the attack, and finally at 4:30 a.m., the signal gun fired again by a Vermont artillery piece, and 14,000 men surge forward in the darkness. And amazingly, Gould and his 50 men get out ahead of everybody, and somebody behind them yells, "Veer to the left," and they veer to the left. And so they're away from the point of the attack, and suddenly they're up against these 8-foot earthworks. Behind them, they've got thousands of Union troops coming, and Gould has to make an instant decision. Do I holler to my comrades, and "It's me, it's me"? Well, that'll never work. So he went over the earthworks and became the first Union soldier to break the Confederate lines. And soon the whole Sixth Corps was flooding over those earthworks. And Petersburg, the lines at Petersburg were fractured forever. And Lee, about a mile away at his headquarters, sent word to Richmond that Richmond and Petersburg had to be abandoned. But it was the Vermonters, famous at Gettysburg, famous in the Wilderness. This is one of their great moments in the Civil War, and it's costly. 25 men are killed and 161 are wounded, including my great-great-great-uncle David Moody Gilson, who came home horribly wounded and died on Christmas Eve.
You know, we've talked about Vermonters' involvement at Gettysburg. We've talked about Vermonters' involvement at Cedar Creek and some other battles. But as you just said, you really feel this might be the most important battle that Vermonters were involved in the entire Civil War. Why is that true?
It's the battle that ends the war. Appomattox comes 9 days later. Appomattox is virtually inevitable after this victory. Now, this was going to happen sooner or later, but it was the Vermonters that did it. I go back and forth, Bob. I wrote a book saying that the Vermonters in the Wilderness was the most important Vermont moment in the Civil War. And then I thought, you know, and I still think it may be Gettysburg, those inexperienced soldiers that broke Pickett's charge. But the more you look at this one, it's a tremendous feat. And those Vermonters were not there by accident. Lewis Addison Grant, the commander of the Vermont Brigade, said that he was rewarded with the honor of leading the charge because his men were such great soldiers and because he had seen the weakness, the point of weakness in the Confederate lines. And the next day, of course, Richmond falls, and the first soldiers into Richmond the morning of this day, 150 years ago, the Richmond people, looking to the east down along the long main road, saw blue coats marching. And they came by the thousands, and the first soldiers, 9th Vermont Regiment, marching at the head, the first Union soldiers into Richmond. And by that time, Jefferson Davis was on a train and fleeing for his life. Good thing that the Vermonters got there, and the 9th Vermont's former commander, Edward Hastings Ripley from Rutland, because Richmond was on fire, and Ripley took charge and put the fires out in Richmond and saved most of the city. It was a great humanitarian act.
Today in the program, our guest is Vermont Civil War historian Howard Coffin. If you've got a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Perhaps you have some relatives who fought in the Civil War. You've just got some questions about Vermont's involvement in the Civil War. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Howard, we got this email from Harry, who wrote, "My great-great-grandfather, Edwin Moody, was wounded on April 2nd, 1865 at Petersburg. He enlisted with a relative, John Moody, who was mortally wounded on the same day. They both got on a train in Vermont, but only one made it home." That's probably a story that's repeated for a number of communities.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the soldiers knew that war was in its last stages, and they knew that if they got killed now, they were going to be very unlucky. Indeed, one of the Vermont captains writes that in ordering the charge, getting the charge going, he had trouble getting some of his men to stand up and move forward. He had to swat them with the side of his sword, the flat of his sword, because I think, you know, they didn't want to die. They didn't want to die in one of these last battles. But they did. You know, the Vermonters always did. They always went forward. There would be troops from other states near them that wouldn't move, but the Vermonters always did. And it's another case of it. And then with the fall of Richmond, with the fall of Petersburg, the chase begins to the west as Lee's army is going west, trying to link up with another Confederate army under Joe Johnston. They're coming up the coast, pursued by the worst pursuer of all, William Tecumseh Sherman. And Lee hopes to link up with Johnston so he can keep the war going. But Sheridan and the cavalry are out at the front of the chase, and that's a tough customer.
You mentioned folks in Richmond could see the blue uniforms coming towards the city. Was there much of a battle for Richmond, or was it just flee and run?
There were just a few shots fired at that Union column of troops coming in, and then the Confederate soldiers got the daylights out of there. They fled. And by nightfall, there were tens of thousands of Union soldiers in the city. And Lincoln will come. And Lincoln will come. Lincoln is right down there outside Petersburg watching the final act. And Lincoln will come into Richmond. And he will be greeted by hundreds of freed slaves. And he dramatically will make his way up the hill to Capitol Square and into the Confederate White House and into Jefferson Davis' office and sit at his desk. Lincoln had a flair for the dramatic, but those black people treated him like a god, and well, they should have.
Now, if I remember correctly, a lot of Richmond is burning at this point. Is there any doubt of who set the fires?
No. The fires were going full blast by the time the Union soldiers got into the city. There had been a lot of rum in some storehouses that were broken into, and the hooligans got into the rum. And there were fires set by the Confederate soldiers as they left to destroy military equipment. But it became kind of, a drunken party in the city. And but for the Union soldiers, most of Richmond, I think, would have been lost.
Today on the program, our guest is Vermont Civil War historian Howard Coffin. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. Perhaps you have some questions or comments about Vermont's involvement in the Civil War. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today, Vermont Civil War historian Howard Coffin. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. If you've got a question or a comment about Vermont's involvement with the Civil War, let's talk to Peter in Middlebury. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had two questions. I'll say them quickly. One, I've heard various figures about per capita losses by state in the Union side in the Civil War. And I wondered if the guest had some answers to that. And secondly, I'm struck by the comment about reconciliation and am unaware in other aspects of world history about whether there is such an immediate reconciliation in a Civil War. Both those questions, and thanks for taking the call.
Yes, Vermont's per capita loss in the Civil War was the second highest among the northern states. Michigan's was just slightly higher. As far as reconciliation, quick reconciliation in another Civil War, my quick answer would be I think this might have been the quickest on the surface. But if you look at modern history, you can make a very strong case that this country is still divided pretty much along the lines of the old Confederacy.
Let's turn to Gwen, who's calling from Burlington. Hi, Gwen. What's on your mind today?
Hi there. Thanks for the great show. I am wondering if there are any cool sites to check out in Vermont to learn more about the Civil War.
Any Civil War sites in Vermont? Well, I have a new book called Something Abides that lists at least 1,500 Civil War sites in Vermont and tells you how to find them. They are everywhere. And, of course, a lot of people don't realize that we had a battle in Vermont, the northernmost land action of the Civil War at St. Albans. But Civil War sites in this state are everywhere, and they're there for your discovery.
And, Gwen, you were thinking about websites, weren't you?
That would be great, too.
Well, I have a website. I must say I'm not terribly efficient at keeping updated, but I'm getting better at it with the help of a neighbor. So you can usually find out what I'm up to on that. yes, the Humanities Council, Vermont Humanities Council, has a website. Although I'm not too tuned in on websites. I guess I'm too old-fashioned.
You were talking earlier about the fall of Richmond, and there were celebrations in Vermont when that happened.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, virtually every church bell that still exists in Vermont from that time rang and rang and rang, and people headed for the center of town to rejoice on the fall of Richmond. That symbolized the end of the war to them, although there was still, you know, almost a week of fighting all the way to Appomattox, and then there'd be another 3 weeks before Johnson's army surrenders to Sherman. But to Vermonters, this was the end, and the big celebration, or one of the biggest celebrations, wonderfully happened in Richmond, Vermont, and just because the name of Richmond was Richmond. That's as far as I can figure it out.
Now, you mentioned that after Richmond fell, Robert E. Lee flees into the countryside. He's trying to hook up with Joe Johnston. You know, I've read that the morale of the Southern troops during that march was remarkably high.
Not entirely. Lee, there's some dispute about the size of the army that Lee led out of Petersburg, but it's probably around 50,000, but it dwindles every day, and his army had been dwindling by desertion, and troops are deserting all the time. And the Southern will to fight is diminishing fast. But Lee's doing all right until he gets about 110 miles to the west and discovers that the Union cavalry under Sheridan with the Vermont cavalry has gotten in front of him, and they're waiting in Appomattox Station where the supply train is. Lee's men are starving, and Lee tries in the morning of April 9th to break through Union lines. He breaks through the cavalry, and then he sees the Army of the James coming on, tens of thousands of men. And he turns to his aide, and he said, "It is time to see General Grant." He was beaten, and he knew it. And there was nothing more he could do. Oh, he could have said, "Head for the hills," but no, it was time to surrender. So he put on his best uniform, and at the Wilmer McLean House at Appomattox, he met a mud-spattered Ulysses Grant. And after 2 hours of negotiation, they agreed to surrender terms. Lee rode away in his splendid uniform and his great horse Traveler, and Grant watched him go and remarked on how magnificent he looked. And then he wrote later how he wondered how such a man could have fought for one of the worst causes ever fought for by mankind, a cause that was trying to destroy the nation that Lincoln called the best hope of mankind, and to perpetuate the horrible evil of slavery that made a joke out of our Declaration of Independence. Interesting. By the way, Bob, this Civil War sesquicentennial fast coming to a close now, but still not over. Next Wednesday night at the State House, there'll be a wonderful program at 7 o'clock, a Farmer's Night program kind of based around the Battle Hymn of the Republic. There'll be a talk on Lincoln's second inaugural. I'm going to speak on Lincoln's funerals here in Vermont, and then Memorial Day in Brattleboro, May 24th, actually, a day-long program. It's going to be one of the biggest events of the sesquicentennial on the Civil War. So it keeps going on, and wonderfully. I hate to see it end.
Well, and our listeners should know that Farmers Night activities are available on the VPR stream. So if you go to the VPR stream and the House stream next Wednesday night, beginning, I believe, at 7:30, you can tune in and listen to that celebration. Let's talk to Bob in Burlington. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you. Hey, I just wondered if there's a way to get in touch with you, Howard, to collaborate some research. I'm a local treasure hunter. I do treasure hunting in different areas in New York State, Upper New York State, and in Vermont regarding Civil War sites. And I just wanted to know how to reach you to collaborate with some overlays that I'm doing with maps, topographical maps. The land mass has changed quite a bit since
I'm
then.
In the phone book, 2231909.
That was easy.
2231909.
2231909, and I answer the phone.
And Howard, we're also going to put a link from your website at the VPR website. So if any folks are interested in learning more about Howard's website that he attends to occasionally by his own admission, we will have that link at the VPR website in our Vermont Edition section on today's show. Let's talk to Gene in Passumpsic. Hey, Gene, welcome to the program.
Yes, I have a question. We moved into a house that was built in the late 1700s. So there was a strange thing on the front door, and finally I looked at it more closely, and it said the grand arm, I can't find it. I stashed it somewhere, so God only knows where I put it. But it's a grand army or of something of Vermont.
It's the Grand Army of the Republic.
Yep, and I was told it fits all the way through the door, and it's like a kind of a turn. I guess it was called a door knocker or something. And I was told the Civil War veterans were given those instead of a medal.
Not that I know of. All the Vermont veterans were given a certificate, a very beautifully designed certificate, and you'll find them it's for sale on the internet and in antiques stores, you know, because there were 35,000 of given out. Something like that would have been produced by the individual chapters of the Grand Army of the Republic, which were the American Legion of its day, and probably they were selling those things for fundraisers. I've never heard of such a thing, and you better find it because it is. It sounds to me it might be unique. Because I sort of collect GAR stuff, and I've never heard of such a thing. So do some dumpster diving or whatever you have to do.
Today in the program, our guest, Vermont Civil War historian Howard Coffin. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. If you've got a question or a comment about Vermont's involvement in the Civil War, 1-800-639-2211. Howard, we got this email from Peter, who wrote us: at the Battle of the Namazine Church in Virginia on April 3rd, 1865, my great-grandfather, Lieutenant Jerome Hatch of the 1st Vermont Cavalry, was credited with charging and capturing a Confederate cannon. His obituary stated that he was one of three sent by General Sheridan to go with General Custer to present the captured cannon to the president. Since President Lincoln died on April 15th, can you suggest how to determine if he ever met with Lincoln or perhaps with President Andrew Johnson?
I've been to Namazine Church many times. It's about, it's probably 30 miles west of Petersburg. It's right on the retreat route. The Vermont Cavalry was there, yes. And I'm not surprised that they captured some guns there. I have never heard of them making a presentation to Lincoln or Johnson, for that matter, but that doesn't mean that it didn't happen. They would have been probably kept on duty until the surrender, and then, which was on the 9th, and then there was the stacking of the arms, the 10th, 11th, 12th. So I doubt that they would have gotten to Washington on time to give it to Lincoln, perhaps to Johnson, but... unfortunately, the Vermonters, when the surrender occurred, were sent way down south to Danville, Virginia, in pursuit of Jefferson Davis. So they didn't get to Washington in time for the grand review, and that's probably when it would have taken place. So I'm afraid it probably didn't happen, but who knows?
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Julian, who is calling from Montreal. Hi, Julian. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I'm calling from Montreal, and
yep.
I have a copy. I'm grateful to your program, by the way, because I have a copy of the New York Times from April 4th, 1865, and I've had it for many, many years. It's my favorite newspaper. I collect old newspapers. And on page 7, they have reports about what happened in all the little towns on the day that Richmond fell, I guess, on April 3rd, and but there's reports from Maine, from Massachusetts, from Connecticut, from New York, but there's nothing from Vermont. And I thought it would be an occasion to ask your historian how people celebrated in small towns in Vermont, because the reports that are in the New York Times here say that people were firing cannons, the church bells were pealing, there were parades, that kind of thing.
Oh, that happened all throughout Vermont. There was absolute joy. People were out in the streets in every town of every size, and they were shooting off their guns, and the bells were ringing, and there was music. Days later, the whole scene changed. The bells that were clanging began to toll slowly, softly, because word came of the death of Lincoln, and it was as if, for Vermonters, as if a family member had died, and funerals, they called them funerals, were held throughout the state. So celebrating and then tremendous grief.
Let's talk to Dan, who is calling from East Dorset. Hi, Dan. What's on your mind today?
Hi. I just had a question about Civil War gravestones, where they were made, because I did find an old one in my foundation when I renovated my house, and I just was wondering if you knew where most of the gravestones were made. I think maybe possibly East Dorset.
There's a story about a quarry in East Dorset called the Gettysburg Quarry, where supposedly gravestones were quarried for the Gettysburg National Cemetery. I've never been able to verify that. A lot of Civil War gravestones apparently were made in Proctor because there was a massive granite operation there, already underway there, and one of our local senators owned the Vermont Marble Company, and he used some of his influence. So it's possible that your gravestone was very likely it was made in Vermont, and there were government issue gravestones. They were small and very plain for those who couldn't afford anything else. But a lot of the soldier families had much more grand stones carved here in Vermont, of Vermont stone.
Howard, we got this email from Jill. I have some Civil War documents that are from the 7th Vermont Regiment and relatives of mine. I have muster lists and assorted other documents that her great-great-uncle Edward Larkin has kept as a clerk for the regiment. Jill's asking, what would be the best thing to do with them? I would donate them, but would love to learn more about them first. Also, where should they be donated?
I would recommend they go either to the Vermont Historical Society in Barre or to the University of Vermont Special Collections. 7th Vermont Regiment, interesting regiment, the Bad Luck Regiment. They had to stay in a year after the war ended, down doing duty down on the Rio Grande in Texas. And they spent a lot of the war at a horrible place in Florida called Fort Barrancas, all mosquitoes and poisonous snakes. But they had a couple moments of glory, particularly at the end of the war, in the capture of Mobile Bay. But that would be very interesting. And either place, great repositories. They'll take great care of them, and they'll be available to scholars like yours truly.
Got just a little bit of time left. Let's see if we can squeeze in a call from Donna, who is calling from Fall River, Massachusetts. Hi, Donna. Welcome to the program.
Hi, sir. I'd just like to share with Mr. Coffin and your listeners that my great-grandfather, Stephen George of Washington, was actually a prisoner at Andersonville and escaped, or at the end of the war was released, and actually walked back home.
Well, he was a lucky man. He couldn't have been in prison very long, because if he had been, he wouldn't have had the strength to walk home. He was a very fortunate man, because 40,000 men were imprisoned there and 13,000 died, and it was a death. It was a death trap. You're lucky to be here.
Vermont Civil War historian Howard Coffin, many thanks for being on the program today and for bringing the history of Vermont to life for all of us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, and my best to my wife, Sue, who isn't doing too well.
Coming up next, I'll talk with retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis about the education bill that passed the House this week. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The House this week gave its approval to legislation that calls for larger school districts across the state in several years. Each district would have at least 1,100 students. If a smaller district fails to merge with other districts by 2017, then the State Board of Education can mandate the consolidation of the smaller districts. Why has this bill become such a top priority for House Democratic leaders? That's one of the questions we have today for retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Bob.
Eric, recently you wrote a column in the Addison Independent about this legislation, and you said this bill has important political consequences. What did you mean?
What I meant is that for the Democratic leadership in the House, particularly Speaker Shap Smith, doing something about property taxes in this session is important. First of all, Smith knows that the Republicans are going to be campaigning on this issue for the next 2 years. And if the Democrats can be seen as doing something that would bring down the rate of increase in property taxes, that might help them fend off Republican attacks and avoid losing too many more seats in the House in the 2016 cycle. Second, for Smith himself, if Governor Shumlin were to decide not to run for re-election next year, Smith would probably be a candidate for governor, and if he ran statewide, he would like to point to something that was accomplished in the area of changing the rate of increase of property taxes.
So I guess one big question would be, will this legislation really have much of an impact on holding down property taxes?
I'm not sure, Bob. The way it was reported out of committee initially, the way it came out of the Education Committee, it would have, because the Education Committee's version of the bill would have imposed a cap on school budget increases of around 2%, in some instances a little bit less, in a few instances a little bit more. But school budgets in the aggregate have been increasing by closer to 3%, so a 2% cap would have certainly slowed the rate of increase in property tax. But the cap was opposed by many rank-and-file members who heard from constituents in their district, who heard from teachers in their district, who heard from school board members in their district. So the bill was passed by the House this week. Mainly deals with administrative reorganization of school districts. There is a cap, but it doesn't go into effect for 3 years, and only then if statewide school budgets increase by more than 3%. So this bill, in my opinion, does a lot less in terms of restraining property tax increases than the version the Education Committee reported out a few weeks ago.
And Eric, we had several Republicans stand up on the House floor this week during this debate and say, this bill is not what voters said they wanted back in November. And so these Republicans said, boy, this falls far short of anything that's going to have meaningful relief for taxpayers. Is that a fair criticism?
Well, it's a fair criticism in the sense that the bill probably won't do much in terms of relief for property taxpayers. But what the Republicans haven't said, both the individual House members who spoke and the Republican Party as a whole, is do they favor the imposition of a cap from Montpelier on what individual school districts can do, and do they favor some of the consequences of that, which in many districts would be a reduction in teaching staff, or in a few instances might mean the closure of schools. And the Republicans talk a lot about local control, yet a cap, which is the most effective way of controlling property tax increases, does mean transferring decisions away from the local level of government and bringing them up to the state level.
Eric, the bill also freezes the residential property tax rate at 98 cents. The rate was supposed to go up to a dollar this year based on the growth of local school budgets on town meeting day, but Democratic leaders decided to take some money from the Education Fund Reserve in order to freeze that rate. It was actually a plan first proposed by House Republicans. Are they using one-time money in order to freeze the rate?
Yes, and there are some fiscal experts who are quite concerned about this. One of them, for example, being Tom Pelham, who worked as a finance administrator for both Governor Dean and Governor Douglas. And keeping the property tax rate down by taking more than the usual amount out of reserves helps for just 1 year. But the following year, unless they want to take the reserves down to a dangerously low level, the reserves will need to be replenished. So that could mean a larger increase in year two.
Eric, there's also a proposal that was introduced earlier this session that makes significant changes in the way that Vermont pays for education. That plan would rely less on the property tax and use a local income tax as the primary source of money. That bill won't be considered during the 2015 session, but do you see it emerging next year?
I'm not sure. I think in concept the idea is very good, and a working group that the speaker appointed included it as one of their proposals for discussion. There's two challenges for moving toward the income tax, and it has some benefits too, though. The challenges are that the income tax does tend to be pretty volatile as a revenue source. Its performance is tied a lot to how the statewide and national economy perform. And that's a concern because education, you want the funding more steady and less volatile. The second is administering a local income tax may be difficult for employers and others who would need to have different sets of withholding tables for their employees depending upon which towns they lived in. So that issue would need to be worked out. The benefit of shifting toward a more income tax-based system, I think, might be particularly for those households whose income is now just above the cutoff for the income sensitivity program, which is around $90,000. Households who are just above that cutoff can see a very significant increase in their property taxes as they move out of income sensitivity into no longer being eligible for it. In some instances, for example, a $2,000 or $3,000 increase in household income could have as a consequence an increase of more than that amount in property tax. So moving toward a more income tax-based system would smooth out some of these so-called cliffs that you now have associated with the income sensitivity program.
Also, Eric, the Vermont Teachers Union seems pretty unenthusiastic about the mandatory consolidation provisions of this bill. They say they support larger school districts, but only if local communities want to do it and that no district should be forced to do it. So do the Democrats run the risk of losing the support of teachers over this bill?
Well, the teachers are an important force politically in terms of both their numbers and the number of votes they can provide and campaign contributions. They're particularly important, I think, in supporting candidates in Democratic primaries that are contested and in closely fought statewide elections. My sense is that one of the main concerns of the teachers, though, is with the cap. And they didn't want any spending caps because they had a real threat in terms of holding salary increases down, maybe even reducing the number of teachers or requiring teachers to pay more for their health insurance than they now do. But I think the teachers also have to be aware, the leadership of the Vermont NEA, that they can't be seen as defending the status quo with absolutely no change at all. And I think some of the things that they were most strongly objecting to were actually removed as the bill was changed from the Education Committee's version to what the House floor passed. And I think, based on previous experience, the teachers may even be more pleased with what ends up coming out of the Senate.
Well, the bill now goes to the Senate Education Committee. Do you think there are going to be some major changes there?
Yes. If you look at last year's experience, the Senate was much less enthusiastic about anything in the area of consolidation than the House was. I think that's because my view on this, Bob, is that there are a lot of House members that represent relatively larger towns. The House, after all, is allocated on the basis of population. So there's a lot of House members that represent larger towns and look at the consolidation and say, well, it might not affect my town all that much because we already are in a district with more than the required number of students. But every senator, even those from Chittenden County, the most populous county in the state, they have a number of small towns in their countywide constituencies. And I think the senators tend to be more responsive to the concerns of some of the smaller towns and school districts than the House members. So I think I'll be interested to see whether the consolidation plan, as it was passed by the House this week, will emerge from the Senate, or whether the Senate does something that focuses much more on incentives rather than mandates. And I think the incentive rather than mandate approach is also where Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb and Governor Shumlin have been focusing their attention.
Retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis, many thanks for being on the program today.
My pleasure, Bob.
That's it for today. Monday on the program, fraternities have been back in the news lately for some abhorrent behavior. We'll look at the role of the Greek organizations and how they play in the social fabric of colleges and universities and what schools should be doing to police their activities. Send your questions or comments about fraternities and sororities to VermontEdition@vpr.net and listen Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels and Rick Sangari, with production assistance from Devin Karambulis. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.